Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Hey, good evening, everyone. Welcome to another Tuesday night installment here at Your Remedies in the Law. Tonight, of course, we're discussing various IRS administrative remedies with our speaker, Mr. Tony Davis. My name is Martin Michaels. I'll be your host for this evening's conference brought to you by Your Remedies in the Law, which is in direct affiliation with Americans Restoring America. Before we get started with this evening, though, it is very important that I provide you with the following disclaimer. Nothing that you hear on this call tonight may be deemed by you in any way, shape, or form to be legal advice. If you are on this call because of a situation in your life where you require legal advice, I very politely ask you to hang up the phone. Now, we don't mean to sound rude when we say this. We just want to express to everyone in no uncertain terms that anyone joining this call looking for legal advice has no place or business here. Nobody here at Your Remedies in the Law or any of the programs offered by Americans Restoring America is a lawyer, attorney, or any member of the bar. Therefore, no one here is able to offer you any legal advice. Should you require legal advice, my advice to you would be get an attorney. As for these calls, they're all just for entertainment purposes. It's just folks saying what they might do where they're similarly situated to you. You might get a little bit of education out of it, but mainly you're just going to get folks' opinions about what they might do. However educated and experienced these thoughts and opinions might be, they are just people's opinions nonetheless, and it's always up to you to do your own due diligence. All right, on to the next subject. I'd like to go over a few things here with Your Remedies in the Law, if I could, very quickly. First of all, if I can take everybody to the homepage of www.yourremediesinthelaw.com, if we look up in the upper right-hand corner, we see a little picture of the Constitution. Click on that, and you'll have a separate page come up with just two items on it. These two items are of much importance, though, especially if this is all new to you. First and most importantly on the left is the jurisdictionary course. This is your 24-hour crash course on the rules of civil procedure. Better known to some as American jurisprudence or ANJUR, the rules of civil procedure are essentially the foundation or structure upon which all law in America rests. So to have a firm and thorough understanding of these rules means to have at least a basic understanding of what's going on in virtually any court scenario that you find yourself in. On the right is the common law default process, mostly known for its high national win rate in most traffic cases throughout the country. At least that's what it's most popularly acquired for. But that is not really why it's on this page. The reason that we have it up here with the jurisdictionary course is when you go through it, you'll notice that it utilizes a lot of the same fundamental procedures that you learned about in the jurisdictionary course. So it kind of acts as a real-life homework assignment. Also, for a lot of folks, it's their first time committing to action. Folks seem a little more willing to take that first step, probably because of such a high success rate and traffic scenarios being such a common interest in this country today. The common law default, although known majorly for traffic purposes, has many other. Truly, it's for most scenarios that you may find yourself in where there's no damage to property or person. It's just some entity is claiming you broke a rule, therefore you must pay a civil penalty. Both of these items are very affordably priced. The jurisdictionary with a contribution of $250 and the common law default at $150. Also on the subject of Your Remedies in the Law, most of you are probably familiar now with Americans Restoring America. Every time you visit the homepage of yourremediesinthelaw.com, you are met with that blue box that pops up asking if you'd like to continue on to the site that you were visiting or stay and visit Americans Restoring America. The reason that we've done this is very simple. We're trying to get folks to explore. There are multiple information providers talking about multiple subjects, as well as many other features and study groups at Your Remedies in the Law. And Your Remedies in the Law is just one of a couple dozen websites that all together make up Americans Restoring America. So there's quite a bit for you to see, and we hope that you'll do just that at your leisure. If you have any questions about whether or not we have an information provider that could give you their personal educated opinion about your particular situation, get a hold of us at yourremediesinthelaw.com, and we'll be happy to assist you in any way that we can. Statewide communications. If you're not already a member, please do sign up. Tell your friends and family about it. That's that map of the United States that you see on virtually every site that we have. It's a private communications platform that enables folks to speak with one another on a local level based on a very strict pre-decided topics of discussion. Essentially, how it works is this. A wizard will walk you through a very easy setup. You know, put your name in here, click next. Put your zip code in here, click next, that sort of thing. Then it will walk you through the remainder of the setup. And then you get to a point where it will ask you what are your hot points interested in. This could range anything from credit card issues, home foreclosure, IRS matters, asset protection, or maybe veterans' rights, maybe personal health rights. Anything that you can think of. And if it affects your personal rights, you should find it in that list or something that's close enough. When the setup is complete, it puts it all together, much of how you think of a social network. Though nothing like a social network. It's very custom, it's very private. But it then puts you in contact with people in your local area that have similar interests to you. The idea here is to put the power of education and communication back in the hands of the common man. If you are in need of legal advice or you need someone to represent you, you're going to have to get an attorney. It's just that simple. But if there was a way, a private place that you could go to discuss matters, your personal opinions, their personal opinions, with people that were like-minded, maybe you jump online one day and you say, this happened to me today. First person comes back and says, well, I disagree with that. I don't think that they should be able to do that. I don't think that's fair. Well, that's probably not going to be of a tremendous amount of help to you. Maybe the next person comes on and says, well, I'll tell you what I would do were I similarly situated. I'd watch these YouTube videos, and then I'd go down there to my local county courthouse, go to the law library, get a law dictionary, and look at these terms. Maybe the next person after that says, those all sound like great ideas. I'd also go to this particular website and check out these educational materials that might assist you in your learning. And then for you to go and do some due diligence on what you're reading, just people's suggestions, people's opinions at all. But if you did some due diligence and educated yourself, maybe the farther you got into it, you discovered that it's not as difficult as you initially thought it would be because you're focused on one single subject. And you get to the point where you've educated yourself, and now you're handling your own affairs, your own matters. Well, folks, there's nothing illegal or unlawful about that. And that's all we're trying to do here at Statewide Communications is just very simply get people to start talking again. Of course, there's no cost to you for using Statewide Communications, either signing up or the regular using of it. And so we hope that you'll pass that around. Freedoms Radio. If you're over the road, you don't want to deal with the call process, and you're just new to your remedies in the law, and you don't yet have your username and password, therefore you can't see the phone number and the PIN. By the way, if you'd like to pick up a membership to your remedies in the law, it's very easy. You just simply click the register button. Fill out your basic information there. You'll enjoy the first 30 days for free to evaluate it. After that, it converts to a very affordable $10 a month on your credit card or your PayPal. But every single call is recorded. You have years of archives to go through, a vast wealth of knowledge, as well as many other wonderful features. But if that's not an option for you today, you have freedomsradio.com. Every night, the calls go out over the air at 9 p.m. Eastern live. There's also the question bar there where you can type in a question, click submit. As long as that's during call hours, that will pop up on the moderator screen, and we do our best to read every single one of those questions out over the air, as long as they are appropriate. So you'll get the one-on-one with the information provider like you would be by being a private member, but you do get your questions answered. There's no cost to utilize Freedoms Radio, so no matter where you are or your circumstances, you never have to miss a call again if you don't wish. All right, so winding down here, I'd like to go over one last bit of housekeeping. This is your caveat emptor, or your buyer beware. For any purchase that you may make, if your remedy is in the law or any of the other sites underneath the umbrella of Americans Restoring America, when you come aboard and you go with an information provider, you are doing just that. Information providers pay Mr. Edward for advertising at your remedy is in the law. This payment would be an expense to that information provider along with any other expenses that they might have associated with your particular product or service. When you contact us, all we simply do is listen to your particular scenario, quickly deduce from a list of folks that honestly most of you would probably never be able to find on your own just simply because they can't be found. Can we make those introductions? Not every part on the information provider is always going to be successful. Everybody always hopes for the best. We plan for the best, and believe you me, we aim for the best. But unavoidable things do sometimes happen, and when they do, you have to roll with them and deal with them as you would with anything else in life. But we also want to emphasize, though, that the intent is always to be successful. If you have any questions of that, we welcome you to visit www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com/testimonials and see what others have to say about these products and services. Now, let's touch very quickly on the subject of refunds or the refund policy. There is none. Not if the remedy is in the law, anyway. Of course, when you come aboard and you go with a particular information provider, again, that is exactly what you're doing. So any discussion of a refund or a credit would be a strict and private matter between you and the information provider, and even then, that's very few and far between. It must be extenuating circumstances. You are expected to have done your due diligence before you commit to any particular process or information provider's time. All right, lastly, pertaining here to all of the information providers at Your Remedies in the Law, we'd like you to remind everybody that all of our speakers at these conferences are our guests and should be treated with the highest level of respect. If you disagree with something that a speaker has to say, that's fine. Disagreeing is how we learn, but please, you must always be civil. Besides, if a question is posed properly and then answered properly, then we can all learn something from it.
All right, Martin, thank you so very much for your disclaimer that you've given us tonight. I want to thank everyone for listening to it, and there's an important reason for it, because for nearly 30 years, I've watched others that do what I do, that is either market other information providers or sometimes just marketing themselves, fail to give an adequate disclaimer and end up being indicted by a grand jury for practicing law without a license. So, you know, we're kind of clear here about it, even make a joke that, you know, hang up if you are looking for legal advice, please. Anyways, tonight's topic, tonight's speaker is going to be John. Right now, John is actually, he's in the hospital. His wife is having surgery tonight. So if you're a praying man or woman, I appreciate you and covet your prayers for her, Patricia. And so he will be joining us in just a few moments. This week's topic is constitutional money, lawful money, gold, silver, and with specificity to the importance of transmitting your transactions with lawful money in gold and silver. And he'll go into depth about how that can be accomplished working with, believe it or not, pawnbrokers or numismatic dealers. For a percentage of them carrying, if you would, their inventory to a location where they can you can turn around and do a transaction. John is covering that tonight. In addition to that, we also have something that we shared with you last night with one of our students, Tommy. Tommy will be bringing that up later with John as well. So without further ado, it's my pleasure to turn this call over to John.
Good evening, Michael. Thank you.
You're welcome, sir. I'm muting out.
Yeah. I'm John. Pleased to meet you.
I know.
Tonight's topic of discussion is real money. When you have a currency that has intrinsic value, that value is identified and locked in as far as what you can and can't do with it, as far as valuation. But if your value is not locked in, then what happens is that that value has to be established by some outside standard. And sometimes that can be at the whim of another individual. If a gentleman gives you an IOU, says I owe you three apples, or I owe you a dinner. If he says I owe you three apples, then you're what you've agreed for
has a standard, a benchmark, to some degree, meaning that he can give you three nice red delicious apples, or he can give you three Granny Smith sour apples, or he can give you a small apple or a big apple back, or small apples or very big apples. So, but if he says he's going to give you a meal, that meal can consist primarily of a bowl of rice, or it could be a surf and turf. And that meal can be a bummer or a bonus. So, you know, but it's pretty much at the discretion of the individual. But if you say that I want 1 pound of fresh apples, that's you define things a little better. And there's less latitude that somebody can, you know, treat you or mistreat you. And it goes both ways. But what happens is that when you have a paper currency, some people look at a paper currency in have looked at paper currency in the past as being a blessing and a benefit. To that end, you know, it's kind of hard holding a lot of heavy metal in your purse, your wallet, your pouch, your pocket. But a transcribed note on a parchment or a piece of animal skin from someone saying, hey, this is worth 1 ounce of gold, refined gold, and or this is worth 2 ounces of silver. You got a fairly reasonable expectation of that. But once again, the difficulty with having that type of currency is that if you're separated from the person that has the heavy metal, then how do you get that heavy metal? And if you're traveling abroad, and maybe this is a banker, and he's got a repository of some heavy metal in this country or this province of that country or this state in the union, and you're halfway around the globe, somebody says, well, thank you, that little note you have there is very, very nice, and but I would really very much like the heavy metal, and I have no compunction to do business with you without you having something of intrinsic value. That leaves you out in the wind, even though you've got a promissory note or an IOU. And a note, always remember, is a debt instrument. A U.S. note or a dollar bill, a bill is a debt instrument as well. So the thing that's very, very important is that somebody's going to issue you a currency in a particular, issue you a note or a bill in a particular currency in a particular denomination. Stability of that currency now calls into question. The questions that we called up now, just by virtue of the short dissertation we just had, actually is almost unlimited. The challenges that can befall you are very, very serious. My great, great, great grandfather purchased for my great, great grandfather for his wedding gift. He took a $20 gold piece and purchased the finest suit that money could buy. My great, great grandfather, when my great grandfather was married, he took a $20 gold piece and purchased the finest suit that money could buy. My great grandfather purchased the same for my grandfather. He purchased the finest suit that money could buy for his wedding. My grandfather did not have a $20 gold piece to purchase a suit for my father. again for one of my father's brothers, one of my uncles. But he did, at that time, purchase what was considered the finest seed money can buy. If you have a $20 gold piece today, you can just about still buy finest suit that money can buy. When, regardless of what the evaluation in pesos or euros or dollars, whatever, or lira, that or marks, Deutsche marks, that that you correspond to a 1 ounce coin, it's irrespective. The purchasing power pretty much stays the same over the years. And to that end, there's a lot you can do with that, a lot you can't do with that. It's a good news, bad news situation. The good news is that for currency can't be devaluated. Right now, there are people in Congress that say, well, we need a little bit more money in the system. And against the, and if you have a $1 bill or you have 1,000 $1 bills issued against 1 ounce of gold in there, then, that 1 ounce of gold is technically $1,000. Or if that's what the current value is, then you issue the paper money and you start to do business. What happens if somebody issues a second $1,000 against that same ounce of coin or ounce of metal? Now the value of what you have just dropped to half by inflation, and you could almost call this guy a road agent or a thief, because what they did was against that same 1 ounce of gold, they've issued now twice as much money, which makes the value of those dollars worth half. And what that means is that the coinage and the paper that you have is now worth substantially less than it was before they issued that initial currency against it. Therefore, as you, the individual holding the currency, now you're at the whim of the individual issuing the currency, whether it's a shopkeeper that has a safe in the back and you've got a 1 ounce bar of gold that he's issued you an IOU, or the U.S. government that's issuing you the same IOU or a bill or a note against that same ounce of gold. They've both just done the same thing. They, and unless they buy back, those dollar bills, and reduce the, amount of IOUs against that, that 1 ounce of gold, your IOU has just been devalued. And so, there's individuals that have managed money over the years that find that having what they call it fiat currency, meaning a currency that's paper that they can adjust the value with by adjusting the liquidity of the money that's in this particular country on one day by drawing in some of the paper and raising the value of that coinage, then they are, or that those notes, then they sell it off. And they do a currency transfer, they buy a lot more of the neighboring country's currency. And then they go ahead and flood the market in country A again, and now the value's gone way down. Now they come back with the same money that they just purchased in foreign country B. They go buy back more of foreign country A's currency, and they make money at it. And it's not hard to manipulate the value of the currency when you're one of the people that holds a lot of the assets and a lot of the currency. So what happens is that at the whim of these individuals deciding that today they're going to make $10 million or $20 million or $2 billion or a half a trillion dollars on currency for today or tomorrow, they the individuals that were at their mercy, that yesterday the loaf of bread was 50 cents, today it's 75 cents. Most merchants, when the value of the coinage or the currency goes up, they don't drop the price of that loaf of bread from 75 back to 50. There are sometimes some ebb and tide, but not much. They once they've started to get that kind of pay for that same loaf of bread, they like to keep that. And so what happens is that for the most part, during each one of these ebb and tide of the value of the currency, cost of goods and services go up. There are some goods and services that are rated not just by the dollar, but by supply and demand. And so when you look at the crude oil futures and the crude oil that's available right now and look at how much you're paying for a price, dollar per gallon or a barrel of oil, those prices change significantly. Now, if there is an ebb in the middle of one of those negotiations, the ebb doesn't take the negotiations don't take the same price that you had before. They take the current price. And so there's times when supply and demand and things like heating oil and food oil, where they will actually change and adjust up or down closer to the current value of the currency. So there's those products and goods and services that seem to only go up, and then there's some, for the obvious reasons that we just explained, that begin to track the actual value of the money. Now, the money managers find that when you purchase an item with a fiat currency, they can determine the value of that fiat currency and how much you can buy or sell. If you're using currency that has some intrinsic value, remember the Constitution is very clear on the concept that and it states specifically that no state may coin any currency other than gold or silver. But it says the states. It doesn't talk about the corporation, limiting the corporation. And the Federal Reserve Act, which went out in 20, the contract with the Federal Reserve, going to the Federal, not the Federal Reserve, was the title. The fact that Alan Greenspan was a citizen, and he actually is a U.S. citizen, not an American national, sat on the board of the Federal Reserve. They made even a little bit more money along the way. What happened was that after the U.S. supposedly declared bankruptcy in 1933 and it was disposed of in 1933, they began leasing currency to the U.S. at the rate of 1/3 of a cent dollar bill that was issued, that they were, for every 1/3 of a cent that they paid for rent, they were allowed to print $1 worth of one face value currency. Now, there was a little caveat there in the contract with the Federal Reserve. All of the debt had to be paid in full. That was the, because that's actually still the only real true currency, heavy metal, that is used, recognized internationally. When some people say, well, invest in land, you know, it's not that, it's not as unstable. That's true. Land is, but of your parcel to buy a Big Mac and a coffee. So you have to have something that's actually negotiable and that can be moved, that is transportable. So we get back to having, in this case, a heavy metal currency. What we find is that individuals who have some heavy metal hanging around are less subject to dynamic instability or financial instability, meaning when there's a roller coaster in the market, et cetera, et cetera. They don't lose everything. And I don't mean investing in metal that's in some vault somewhere, because that issue about you being separated from that which you hold the title to is separated. And if that institution should burn down or we should lose that monetary instrument, well, title to that particular coin or that little bar is now gone away. So actually having the heavy metal in possession is very, very good. Now, there's something else that's kind of interesting. Like safe bonds, double eagles, that's all U.S. currency. But it's in gold. A while back,
John, can you hear me?
And
John,
I arranged.
John, can I?
Yes.
John, can I get you to hang up and call back in, please? Your voice is modulating horribly. It's got a bad handshake, I think, to begin with.
Okay, I'm hanging up right now.
All right, thank you. So John will be back in a moment. What we're talking about here, though, is the essence of this is that you. Well, how about this? If you have, say, $100,000 that you're wanting to buy a home for $100,000, and of course I'm just making up numbers here, and you were to go to someone that we've already got an agreement with that says we would like for you to take your $20 U.S. $20 Walking Liberty gold coin.
Is this a little better?
Much better. Yep. Go ahead, John.
Okay. Do I need to back up a little bit?
As far as you can go, sure. Because I think most of us missed what we heard, what you were saying.
Okay. As metal, values assigned to the heavy metal is significantly more stable than the value that you can assign to a piece of paper by printing more of the paper. If you say that if you issue an IOU against 1 ounce of gold, then that IOU is worth 1 ounce of gold. But if all of a sudden you print another IOU against that ounce of gold, now, the original IOU, and so you print it against the same IOU, the same ounce of gold. Now, the original IOU is only worth half of what it originally was. And this is the difficulty with Congress approving, et cetera, spending and putting more money into the system, more dollar bills. There's only X amount of heavy metal that they actually have, and the value of it every time they print or issue another IOU against that is depreciating the value of not just the original IOU, but everyone that's been issued since then. And literally, that is fraud upon the people. And legislators and administrators have gotten to the point where they brush it off with a simple word that this very insidiously wrong called inflation. And what it means is that they have stolen our money. And now when you get to the place where you have heavy metal, gold or silver, that doesn't roller coaster and can't be adjusted with the whim of a keystroke at a bank or a monetary or administrative institution. As I said many, many years ago, in the late 1700s, a $20 gold piece purchased the nicest suit money could buy. And all the way through the 1800s and even in the 1900s, a $20 gold piece still purchased, and even to this day, still purchases the nicest suit that money can buy. So when you think about what the currency, how the currency roller coasters, and the fact that most of us on this call either bought houses or our parents bought houses in the 60s and 70s, and depending on your what jurisdiction you're in. During the 60s, some houses sold for anywhere from $6,000 to $8,000. There's some very nice ones that sold for $40,000 to $60,000. Nowadays, those homes are worth anywhere from $150,000 to $1.2 to $1.5 million. But the same amount of gold will still purchase that house that did originally. Now, the one good thing about a lot of the gold coinage that was out there is much of it still is there's much still out there. And back in the 90s, when the Dodge Brothers Motor Car Corporation was still producing Vipers, this one gentleman, he said he wanted to buy a Viper. And, he wanted one that the state didn't have title to. And so we talked about to the dealer about getting the MSO, Manufacturer Statement of Origin, and the salesman that we originally talked to says, oh, that's not possible. And he had to talk to his supervisor, who talked to the manager. We ended up talking to the vice president of the dealership. He says, oh, yeah, that is possible. You know, but at first, the salesman we were chatting with was unbelievably emphatic that the MSO could not be had. And so we ordered the Viper. He says, well, we're going to pay cash for it. Okay, cool. Remember, this is back in the 90s, and there wasn't any DHS or Homeland back then. What happened was that we showed up on the day of the purchase with gold coins. And back then, the Vipers were cheap. They were $88,900. They were just under $90,000. And we had some $20 gold pieces. And the $20 gold pieces back then, at this particular time, they were going for right around $1,000. So we had 40 of these $20 gold pieces that it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that, you know, five of them is 100, and now it's $800 with the face value. And there were three numismatic $20 gold pieces. One of them was worth almost $30,000. And so the bottom line was the purchase price was $870 in face value. And the guy at the dealership got really upset. You know, he says, well, we can't take this. He says, well, there's another gentleman here that he's been wanting to buy this exact gold, and he just happens to have in cash $100 bills and 20s, everything you want. So you can sell it to him right after you get done. And so he did, and all of a sudden they were filling it out, and the clerk called the Department of Motor Vehicles, got the assessor collector. Back then I knew him personally, Mr. Betancourt, and called his office and had his deputy come over there and say, and she asked, excuse me, I'm from the assessor collector's office, you know, and we want to know what the value of that gold is. I says, for what purpose? She says, well, that's what we're going to assign for the purchase price. And back then, I had a friend that worked for the Treasury Department, and I knew a gentleman who worked for the Justice Department. I called them both up, had them on the phone at the same time on the same conference call, and I asked them, I says, what's the charge for assigning a different or arbitrary value to U.S. currency, to coinage or paper mint? And both of them jumped in and says, oh, that's a second-degree federal felony. One girl, she worked for the Justice Department, says, John, do I need to send somebody out there, or do you have something? And all of a sudden, the assessor collector looked real sheepish, held her hand up to her mouth and, like, zipped across as if, like, nope, I'm not saying a thing. I didn't say a thing. I'm not talking. There's no, you know. And she was very quiet and very deep, went silent and deep. And the sale price was $870. That Dodge Viper, they paid taxes on $870. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that that worked out to $58.92 in sales tax on a Dodge Viper. So when you use real money, all of a sudden, things, you know, your taxes all of a sudden become very, very different, and it's not near as bad. There was a little housing development. This is going back to 1981. In the District of Columbia, where there were 14 homes in this one little subdivision, and the cheapest one back then was $27.8 million, and that was the least expensive of all the homes in there. And what happened was, is over a 2.5 year period, this gentleman who lived in Costa Mesa, California, he took me out there, took me with him multiple times, and we did closings in gold. And the assessor collector was just livid. And we did, and I did the pick up the phone thing, and, you know, what, you know, and they, bottom line was, is that one of the parcels, which was over $56 million back then, the taxes on it, were less than $3,000. And so they, after 11 homes, and in District of Columbia is a quote unquote an ad valorem state or a jurisdiction, meaning that, the taxes are exclusively, registered and levied on actual cash value. So what happens is that market sets the value, and the fact that 11 of the 14 homes had all transacted for gold, and now the other remaining homes, and the fact that this had gone on for 2 years, what happened was that the market for these homes was now, they were paying taxes on almost nothing. And so what happened was the property tax issue all but evaporated for these people that, for all intents and purposes, on a normal given day, would be paying, on that one parcel, the annual tax rate, they were paying on that, one that was up in the 20s, they were paying almost $3 million a year in taxes. We got it down to 4,000. Now when we did the transaction, we had quite a few of those numismatic, coins there that, accounted for almost 16 million. We had 9 coins that counted for almost $16 million in value. And to that end, what happened was, is it was very, very easy to finish the transaction with, coins that now, back then, they were, it was, $360 some odd an ounce. And, so we had to use a lot of coinage back then. But the numismatic, once it had a high value, it made a very, very big difference for us. After 2.5 years of doing this, this gentleman was charging 8% for his services of using his gold. He was making quite a shiny nickel, and increased his, supply of heavy metal or his storage, immensely. And, what happened was that he began to, the other individuals began to slowly contract with him, because as time goes on, they would come out, and there's a thing where they, there was an annual cap rate of 8% for this jurisdiction for them to, raise the property taxes. Well, what happened was, is as they were able to, they would start to, slowly raise the taxes, and, they increased the value. And, but over the next so many years, about once a year, once every other year, Gene would come out and they would transact one property, and it kept the property values for all the way up till the last I heard about it, 2005, they were still keeping the property values down, and Gene passed away in 2005. His legacy lived on. Apparently, these individuals slowly, with some of the assets that they had saved from having to pay the property tax, they went and garnered and purchased enough heavy metal on their own, and they even purchased some of Gene's personal assets of heavy metal. Well, they began to keep on doing it themselves, and they did good with it. And apparently before Gene passed away, they had already been doing this for quite a few years on their own. And Gene was coaching them, and for a small fee, he was able to just give them guidance when they needed it. And when they needed a little extra heavy metal, Gene got his 8% on whatever he had used to assist them. And so it was quite a growing concern. Now, since then, there's quite a few places where we may have done this more than once or even twice. There's a sleepy town in Pennsylvania that we might have accidentally done the same thing as well, and two in Massachusetts, and one in Rhode Island, and et cetera, et cetera. And there was even a place not too far from where I live in the Houston area that we had done it with. And some of the individuals that were syndicating it together, they got some infighting when one of the properties, when the parents died, it went to probate, and the children, the infighting, destroyed it.
John, you're rubber banding again. The last that we heard was something about infighting. Children infighting.
I'm sorry. Yeah. There was some infighting with the children, and they weren't quite as thoughtful and considerate to their fellow person as their parents had, and the parents were both killed in a car accident the same night, and hit and run drunk driver. But what happened was that when it went to probate, the children, they, oh,
they turned into a fish feed. And the fact that the father had been loaning the money, the gold, to the others to keep up the transactions and et cetera, et cetera. And some of these transactions were corporate transactions, meaning that they had either a trust or a corporation that was buying or selling the house, so that they maintained everything that was necessary to strike and keep the ad valorem tax issue alive in that jurisdiction. And so, but with the children and the infighting, that whole neighborhood went from the most expensive house in that neighborhood was $7.5 million, and they were paying just under $600 a year taxes, but it went down to it shot up to almost $1 million a year in property taxes. I know somebody that his father, I had helped him do the thing for their house and their farm, and the young man, he says, well, I can make money at this. And so he went to Colorado, and he started a regular business, and he even at one point held two seminars where and people were paying $10,000 a ticket to go to the seminar, you know, and he had like 30 some odd people there at $10,000 a bite, which wasn't bad, except one of them was a deputy sheriff. And he bought a county prosecutor with him. And they, that gentleman is still serving time for tax fraud, for fraud on the county there. And those folks kind of frown on that. It's very, very important that what happens if you're going to do something where you're keeping track of your money by using real money, and you're keeping your taxes covered, if you're going to help somebody, go help them. That's not a bad thing. If you're going to start charging for services like that and start doing that can get you into legal trouble, and you need to be very, very careful. And based on the differing jurisdictions, the way that it'll get you in trouble is very different. But if you're lending money, i.e. heavy metal, gold or silver, and you're lending it at a fixed rate, it's very hard to arrest a person for that, especially when you're using, you know, when your rate is 8% and the going lending rate at the real estate office is, you know, 12 or 15 in some of those, or the bank is lending it at 16 or 18 and the credit cards are 29, you know, now you can't be charged with fraud. So it's very, very important that if you're going to consider doing something like that just for yourself, that's one thing. If you're going to do it to help somebody else out, okay, more power to you, so be it. That's a good thing. But if you're going to try to make a business out of it, it's very, very important that the way you do it, that you don't violate state or local laws or appear to be committing fraud. When it comes to property taxes, like I said, if you purchase property using real money, then your property is a very different cost and a very different value. If your property is not actually your property, if it belongs to someone else, like a charitable religious trust or a corporation's soul, that actually does qualify as a 501 or a 508 2C2, et cetera, one of the, or a 508 2C4 under the IRS code. And if anybody has any questions about that, I encourage you to listen to Justice Breshear's call. He is very good at explaining how to, you know, have a ministry entity donated to that, and, you know, and leave it there for, you know, for the good of whoever and however. Those entities don't pay property tax. And so, property taxes, how you choose to abate them, there's a variety of ways that you can pursue that. And I heartily recommend that, if you're interested and you feel capable of doing something about yours, well, the first person to talk to is obviously Michael. And Michael will fill you in and set you up with, depending on your specific situation, he'll set you up with the correct information provider to help teach you how to do what you need to do. It's very, very important that you know what you're doing. I used to have run a halfway house back in the 70s, in early 80s. I was taking in people from early releases from Chino Men's Institution in Southern California. And you would not believe how many people I talked to inside the prison and ones that had come through my house. And it was unofficial. I just happened to know a judge or two. And they asked me, he said, John, you got an extra room. You think you could take somebody in? If I gave him early release, could I put him at your place for a year or 2 years? You know, and I used to do that. And some of these people, one of them, he says he still didn't know, never figured out what happened, but his accountant did everything, was doing his books, and never figured out how he could have been possibly liable for the charges that he was prosecuted for. There's people that they hire somebody to do something for them. They don't pay any attention to what's going on, and they think it's the people that they're working with. They treat them like smart missiles. They fire and forget. And it is absolutely not that way. You, right now with the information providers that Michael has corralled to offer assistance to you, if one of us gives you a man a fish, we fed a man for a day. But if I teach you how to fish, then we fed a man for life. And so it's very, very important that we teach you how to fish, and we teach you what you're doing and how to do it and what's the right way and what's the wrong way. Hence the reason that I use a lot of word pictures and word studies so that to help you understand. And sometimes I explain some of the practical circumstances that surround the what I'm sharing, so that you understand that it can be done, did get done, how it got done. And I'm trying to explain to you the pitfalls so that the most important thing out there, doing it right is more important than doing it fast. Doing it right is more important than accidentally getting arrested. Doing your due diligence, if it takes you an extra 6 months or a year to learn how to do it right, legally, lawfully, and economically, there's a value in being patient. There is extreme value in that. To that end, I encourage you, if you don't have any heavy metal or any monetary instruments of intrinsic value, that I encourage you to slowly acquire those. They're available on the internet. You can just do a search on any search engine. With that, my time has come to a close, and I return you back to Michael. Thank you, Michael.
Well, thank you, John. Appreciate you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, press star 2 on your keypad to raise your hand for a question. Press star 2. For those of you on Freedoms Radio, simply look to the center right of your monitor. You'll see a silhouette of a rectangle laying on its side. And just type in your comment or question there. Underneath, you'll see a place to put your name and anything else that you care to provide, and then hit submit. And I'll be glad to give voice on my end to your comment or question. Now, in addition to John's comments tonight, we're going to return with Tommy and share with John, and he's already aware of this, what happened today, or not today, a couple days ago, with regard to Tommy having processed his correcting his status in the proper form that he went through, and then what recently happened. So I'm going to ask Tommy, let me open this microphone here. Here we go. Tommy, would you just share a brief history without going into the details of the nitty-gritty of what happened, and then wrap it up with this week's effects, if you would, please?
Okay. Last week, I received...
Let me just start with this. For everybody to understand, Tommy is a convicted felon. Listen, with 99% conviction rate by the feds, we all, once tagged, would all be convicted of some felony or another. All right, so let's just put that aside. Now go ahead and share your story, please.
Okay. About a week ago, I received a voter registration update notice. And so I filled out the form. On the top of the form, first part, it has, are you a United States citizen or United States national? Well, of course, I clicked no. And on top of the form, I typed in affidavit attached. And under that, I put, I am American national. And I turned in the form with my affidavit of political status correction and a copy of my passport. And I think it was, Saturday, I received a confirmation in the mail from the Louisiana State Registrar of Voters stating, notice letter of irregularity. This office has received information which provides reason to believe that the person whose name appears on this notice may no longer be qualified to be registered to vote in Louisiana for the following reason. Highlighted, you are not a United States citizen. And this is in... Let's see. It is presumed that the information is correct and the registrar is required by law to cancel your name from the list of eligible voters pursuant to Louisiana Revised Statute 18:193-GOLF. That's it, Michael.
Thank you. Thank you. So the question is, let me see if I can find this real quick, please. Go to my sent emails. So then share with them that you went back to your court case and you were instructed in writing or verbally, you'll have to clarify that, that they will retry the felony crime you were accused of and make a determination based on my on your case? What's that? Tommy? Did I mute you? Oh, wait a minute. All right, you're unmuted now, Tommy. Did you hear what I said?
I only caught part of it. My phone dropped the call. I just now called back in. Could you repeat what
no
you
problem.
Said?
I don't know if you were told this or if you received this in writing. You went back to the courthouse regarding your felony crime, and you were told, quote, they will retry the felony crime I was accused of and make a determination based upon my case, end quote.
When I went back to the office, they told me that I had to get an attorney to fill out a motion of removal, and they have to retry the case, and it has to go through a state district court.
Okay. Now, you realize that in hiring an attorney that would be fatal to your position.
I know that.
Okay. John, what's your feedback on this?
Once you've gotten yourself out of their clutches, out of their roles as a United States citizen, you don't want to do anything to put yourself back into that. And at this juncture, now they have to have an injured party that's willing with a verified complaint. And, that's a game changer right there.
Okay. Specifically regarding going back, revisiting his case, because this correction is nunk-pro-tunk. It's challenging jurisdiction to begin with, having nothing to do with any alleged crime. It has everything to do with being collared, if you would, to begin with, under a jurisdiction that he never was a part of. So is there a way to utilize this tool to open his case and get the judgment voided for lack of jurisdiction?
Yes. Yes, there is.
That's what I'm talking about.
Yes, and to fill in the foundational work on that we would need at least one call, if not two calls, to cover that. Maybe we should schedule that for next week.
Okay, privately.
Sure. I wanted to call you today about 4:00, but my cousin came in from Colorado and is visiting. So I didn't get to do that.
Yeah, a little after 4:00, I was in the process of taking my wife to the hospital for a procedure. I respectfully and regrettably, I wouldn't have been able to. I did take a couple of calls, like on the road and everything else, and you probably noticed that the road noise in the background for the first part of the call. I just got home, and my wife is resting comfortably. She has two more procedures. That one of them will be next Tuesday again. I may be a teeny bit compromised for the call next Tuesday, but thank you. Let's plan on touching base tomorrow or Friday. How's that sound?
Tomorrow is great. About what time? In the morning or.
Do you have afternoon time available? Say after 1 or 2?
Yes.
Let's
I'm in Central Time. I'm in Central
yep,
Time.
Yep, I am as well. I remember that.
Okay.
By the way,
okay.
I also checked on flights, and it looks like there may be maybe some fairly decent flights. By the way, you're in the airport that's close to you is Baton Rouge, right? BTR?
Correct.
Thank you. I'm not saying that I actually go out and help students, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. If you got that impression, I'm not me. I'm some other guy. I'm from the Bronx. But if there was just some fly on the wall somewhere, from time to time, we may do whatever it takes to assist our students. Nothing I'll admit to in public. You tell anybody, you ruin my rep, I'll deny it all. Okay.
Well, the takeaway from this conversation, ladies and gentlemen, is that once you've corrected your status, whatever the issues are that are in your past, and no matter how far back, sir?
Yep, the rules are different.
Well, what I'm saying is
changed.
Right. No matter how far back it goes, 30 years ago, doesn't matter. There's no time bar on jurisdictional claims. So I just want you to hear that there are potential solutions for you to deal with. That's all. All right. Let's see if we have any questions here. Press *2 on your keypad, ladies and gentlemen, to raise your hand for questions. Otherwise, it'll be a short call tonight, and you know how I hate that. Let me check Freedom's Radio while you're all thinking about pressing *2. On your keypad. Anonymous writes in, I have a question for Tommy. When you got your passport and card after correcting your status, does it say felony on it?
Yes, it does.
Okay. Thank you.
On the inside of the back cover, Tommy?
No, it's a new style card. You have the hard card in it, and then just above that is a blank page, and it has the felon thing at the top.
Yeah, that's the first page inside the back cover, correct?
The front cover.
Or first page inside the front cover?
Yes.
Oh, okay. They moved it. Okay.
Yeah. The first page is the hard card, and then above that is the soft page bearing my signature.
Yeah, that's per an international treaty that the State Department was above their heads, and they have no say-so in that at all. The only option that they have is to not issue a card and a passport. And having spoken with someone over there, they commented that whenever possible, and this lady was very, very well-read. She says, they have a constitutional right to travel, so we're going to put the notation in there, and the country that they're visiting can take it like whatever they want to, but our citizens, regardless of whether they're felons or not, have a right to travel, and they have inalienable rights even when they're traveling.
Okay, now will this still stop me from having a pass card?
What do you mean? Oh, you mean the to get through airport security?
Yes, I can't get a passport with this.
You may be able to. I know two people that have that on their passports that have pass cards.
Okay, let's work on getting that.
Just because they qualify as known. Okay.
Okay.
All right.
Okay, anything else?
I'll talk to you more about that.
Sounds good.
Okay.
All righty. Next is Anna Maria. Go ahead, Anna Maria from Greensboro.
Hi. Good evening, everyone. I just wanted to share, well, with this gentleman, a question I have is, does he have a certificate of relief?
Yes. Somewhere.
Okay. I until everything gets straightened out with your card and everything, I would think having that certificate of relief in the meantime, and I do not know this 100%, I'd have to research it, but with the certificate of relief, that is granting you the ability to say that you do not have a felon. You are legally allowed to say no. So I was thinking, without knowing 100%, that it shouldn't be on your passport with that certificate of relief. until you, you know, get your card and everything else is straightened out. I don't know. What's your thoughts about that, John?
He's already got his card, quote unquote, straightened out.
Gotcha.
You've got a good point there. Let's look into that. That's a very, very good point. There are times when, the State Department, the Justice Department makes mistakes and there's, cracks that people have slipped through, or things that have fallen through. It's not a good thing to be in a hurry to point those things out. They have a nasty habit of trying to correct them, if you catch my meaning. If there's a slot where he might slip through, you might have just pointed it out.
Okay, I see what you're saying. Okay.
Very good.
The other thing
that was the right response.
Thank you. The other thing is, I just want to share that I do have my religious trust and corporation soul. I live in the state of Florida, and I am in the process of filing for the ad valorem being exempt for the tax, property tax. And I do have to say, every state, you know, Florida has their own rules and regulations about it, and then every county that you're in has different requirements and the questions they ask you for, you know, proof that you're a religious society or organization, even down to wanting a financial statement. So I believe every state and every county is going to have different things that they're going to ask you for.
Don't worry, it's much worse than you think. Yeah, right, John. Yeah. Thanks. I appreciate the moral support. I promise to return it when you need it the least. One of the gentlemen that, young gentleman that we sent over to get his passport and his status corrected just in the last 10 days, he got grilled by the agent in the passport office. She gave him the raspberries, and the supervisor watched. She, you know, he had a claim in his on his declaration that he that this thing was a for a religious objection, that he was not able to do something, you know. What happened was that, come to find, you know, all those type of passport applications go all the way to the top to get approved. They and this gentleman, when they finally when the dust finally settled, you would not believe what he was made to go through, and he stood the test. There's an old saying, always be ready to give an answer for the hope that you have. And this young gentleman did. And unbelievably, he made such an impression that the individual at the passport office wanted to know more. And if this religious, we had one administrator says, if this religious thing is correct, he says, if there's anything truth about this, he says, he wants in. So when it comes to, you know, corp soul, religious, charitable religious trust, be honest. Hey, listen, this life is only so short, you know, and, you know, if you compare a person's life to all of the recorded history eternity, which right now recorded history is truly 6,000 years. So if you liken that to an hour of the day, and, you know, it's what happens is or to it's you divide 6,000 by 100, it becomes 60, just like seconds or minutes. And the average lifespan of a man it's 100 years, we'll go with 100 there. So if eternity was 6,000 years and 100 years is the equivalent of 24 minutes on that calendar, doing the math, figure it out. Can you take, put up with being abused, mistreated, blustered, bullied, beat up, shot for 24 minutes so you could take the other 23 hours and 36 minutes to enjoy life, you know, in pure paradise and bliss? Oh, ding, 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 bonus points. You get a new body at the end of the 24 minutes. I mean, and so what happens is that just whatever we're dealing with right here, just remember it only lasts so long, and you're going to pass it on to somebody else. There's an old saying, it's called the acid test of ownership. And I want everybody to think in your mind right now about something that you own. And it's something you know you own. And now here's the acid test to prove that you really do own it. If you either bought it with you when you came to this rock, or you can take it with you and you didn't leave, and you the man, or you the woman, you the girl, you the guy, but if you didn't bring it with you when you come to this rock, or you can't take it with you and you leave, then it kind of begs the question, whose is it? Is that the guy with the sheep and the cattle on 1,000 hills and all the gold and silver therein? And what are we doing trying to cling to something that we can't keep? There's an old saying, it says, he is no fool who gives up what he can't keep for that which can be never taken away from him. The charitable religious trust, you know, that Justice Brashear sets up, et cetera, the corpse souls, et cetera, they were taking things out of the hands of the ancestor collectors and were putting it in eternal hands. Those who, the posterity of those that we designate or our heirs or our posterity or the designated successor of the office of that particular CRT or corpse soul. So, by the way, there's no longer any probate or inheritance taxes or anything due with the transfer of the property. So, once again, I encourage you to, if you have properties like Anne Marie does, get the corpse soul and the charitable religious trust set up as necessary to protect the property. If somebody picks a fight with you, they can't take away from you what is not yours. Back to you, Michael.
All righty. Thank you so very much. Anna Marie, is there any other questions or comments for you?
No, thank you. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
All righty. Thank you. And then Ron, what do we got to say for Ron tonight?
Yes. Could an individual come into a large sum of money? How would be the easiest way to convert that into gold, or at the exchange, could that be paid out in gold or silver?
The best way is to do it in small chunks. I do know some individuals that, let me rephrase that. I might know an individual or two that, depending on the size of the quantity, that may be able to help get some, direction on that. That's an answer for, a one-on-one call. When you have some time, give Michael a call and we'll chat.
Okay. Michael's aware of my situation. So, that will be something for a future conversation.
Okay.
And since you brought it up, let me just express to everyone that in my former life, I was a manufacturing wholesale retail jeweler, and I dealt intimately with a refiner in New Jersey for 20 plus years. And the moment I have jingle, jangle, jingle to work with, I will be visiting associates in New Jersey to see if I can't purchase the refiner. So just to let you know. John?
Yeah. I may already know a refiner. I may know people that bring in 10, between 10 and 40, 50 metric tons a week. It's yeah, like I said, there's that's let's talk about that sometime when we can fully address your concerns.
Copy that. All right. Anyone else? Press star 2 on your keypad. Otherwise, we're going to say nighty-night. And we don't want to do that so quickly. Or do we? Let me go check Freedom's Radio, see if we have anyone else adding questions over there. Nope. That's been refreshed. And Jennifer comes back. Go ahead, Jennifer.
Hello, gentlemen. I just have a question about my chain of title. I feel like I have the whole thing except for either one or two deeds for the same people. There's two properties that may have been purchased together or separately missing. So what happens if you cannot find one thing in your whole chain of title?
Jennifer, those situations vary greatly. There's no pat answer for that. Usually, when we were doing the records repository, recovery for Austin, the capital here in Texas, a gentleman, Don and I, there were things that, couldn't be found one way or the other. At least we didn't believe they could be found. But there's ways around. I haven't found a puzzle yet that we somehow didn't find all the pieces. I won't tell you that it's easy, but some of the puzzles were kind of toughies, but we were able to eventually find all the pieces. So it's one of those things where, it's either going to be easy or quick, but I haven't yet found one that I wasn't able to find. Okay.
And so does one have to wait till that would be found before moving forward in the next step, whatever that may be, in you know, trying to get your alloidial title and off the tax roll?
Jennifer, in two of the cases, we were able to prove that the deed that was missing, there was no legitimate expectation that this individual would have been deeding the rights to a municipality or authority or to somebody else for easements, etc., or appurtenances, and the whole taxing authority issue. So what's happening is that sometimes if there is something missing, sometimes there's a way around it. But we've, so far to date, I will tell you that later on we did find the missing piece on that puzzle. But in the meantime, a judge was willing to rule in this lady's favor. And he ruled in her favor 4 years before we actually found the missing piece.
Mm. Okay. I'm just wondering, what is the process? After you get the chain of title, what is the next step?
The easiest way is usually to go with the title company and have them confirm all the information that we've got, and What happens is then we get a judgment from a court that they agree that, and in your case, that it's going to be that you're not required to file or pay property tax, that you are the highest authority for that. And so and we'll take that court order over to the assessor collector and thank them for their time and ask them to stop sending fan mail.
Okay. So can I go to any title company or?
Well, right now there's two title companies that I favor. One of them is Lawyers Title and the other is Chicago. I'm getting to know Orange Coast Title and Old Republic a little better. There's a handful of good title companies out there, but Chicago Title and Lawyers Title are the ones that I've trusted in the past. But you know, we'll just have to see as we go.
So they don't have to be in my physical area where I live.
It doesn't have to be, but I'll tell you this: do you want when you're looking for a title company like this, do you want somebody that knows the locale or is located somewhere else that may not be familiar with the transactions that you might be looking for?
Well, I thought I'd want someone in the locale.
Yep.
Am I?
Yes,
yeah?
That's the right answer. Yes, totally the right answer, girl. And so if we can find somebody that can do that, or one of the broad spectrum, like Lawyers and Chicago Title, both have offices in every state in the union.
Oh, I see.
You know, so they, Chicago Title, that's one of the things that I've been using them off and on for probably 38 or 40, 41, 42 years I've been using them. And and I don't use them for everything, but there's a lot of tasks that I do use them for. Yeah, and that's one that may work for you.
Okay, thanks. And I guess, do they charge a fortune?
No. Chicago and Lawyers are both kind of more reasonable. They're middle of the road. There are some title companies out there that are very expensive. Usually the expense comes when you're trying to underwrite the insurance, okay? Otherwise, most of the title companies out there are fairly competitive.
Okay.
Yeah, they have to do business and live around the same people you and I do. So they try to maintain some competitiveness.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, thanks very much. I'll look forward to talking to you further about exactly what to do. Okay. Thanks a lot, John. I hope you're feeling, you sound like you're feeling a lot better, and I'm glad for that, and your wife.
Yeah, I am feeling better. Thank you. It was a bit of a toughie. Thank you.
Okay, next is Brent, and followed by Anita. Go ahead, Brent.
Yeah, just following up on Jennifer's subject matter. Are you guys providing a service for that now, or is that something that you're just kind of helping us through with these phone calls?
Michael, you want to address that?
Well, yes and no. We're not going to actively pursue this. I'm not going to hold calls for it right now. To tell you the truth, the plate is pretty full right now with many of the information providers that are involved with these efforts. However, if you have an interest in pursuing it, I would not take your call, and I would take your call and do some exploratory conversations with John and see if it's something that you understand or want to pursue.
Well, I ordered Ron Gibson's materials earlier this year, spring. I haven't had a chance to go through all of it. It's just, you know, to me, it's just an enormous mountain of paperwork that it's just insurmountable. It's like climbing Mount Everest without oxygen to me. And so
he has a lot of education to offer, doesn't he?
Yes, he does.
That's as tacky as I can put that.
I'm not sure if my property even qualifies. There are some mineral rights that are reserved to the heirs of a former ranch that used to own the property. Can that be resolved? And I think there is also an easement that is reserved to a nearby railroad that's like 5 or 6 miles away.
You understand what easements and the appurtenances are, basically? It's like when you have 9 slices of cake, and you take on that cake, the original cake is perfectly square, but there's 9 slices. But when you take one and you sell it to somebody, and they sell it to somebody else, or this person's using it for that, or whatever, it's to go get it back, you have to basically buy it back. It was sold, and so it needs to be repurchased. There are some people that on rare occasions have gotten easements that were sold to somebody, the sale voided, but they had special circumstances for good cause. But selling an easement is selling part of the property. And that's one of the things that when we were talking with about earlier about that one link in the chain about the deed that we couldn't find, did they sell off the mineral rights, or did they make it part of a housing development that is now part of that is being taxed or taxable? Or did it, was it not never part of an original land grant of French or British or Belgian or Spanish land grant where the taxing authority is the owner of the property, and that eminent domain does not supersede, contrary if you do this research on the internet, it says eminent domain, there is no such thing as a lodeal title in the U.S. They say eminent domain supersedes that, but it does not. Article 9 of the Constitution says the rights here in the, enumerated within the Constitution are not meant to disparage or deprive those already previously held by the people. Okay? And eminent domain was something that was enacted underneath the Constitution, under the authority of the Constitution. So,
okay.
Yeah, they've...
Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
Is it possible to have a title company do the title chain of title research, or is that something that you have to do and then have them verify it?
For those of us who are over 23, and it was murder turn 23, I don't know what I'm going to do when I hit 26. But for those of us who have a few less shopping days in front of us than we do behind us, it's always best to start with a good title company and say, hey, look, I want the etymology of this title, this deed from birth to mortality to current. And go ahead and pay their fee. That is the absolute best place to start. Because they have resources that most regular citizens don't have access to. And then what happens is it comes down to you just having to fill in the missing blanks, okay?
Okay.
Don't bother to tell them that you're searching for a lodeal title. They liken those to treasure hunters or gold prospectors, okay?
Understood.
Okay, good.
But it's hey. Say the term again.
Say it one more time.
what is the term?
I would like the etymology.
Etymology,
of this deed, or this parcel, or this tract, from current all the way back to the original land grant. Where do you live?
Where's the property?
Yes. Where's the property?
It's in Yavapai County, Arizona.
Ah. Back to the original land grant. That's the abstract.
Okay.
Yep, that was a Mexican land grant. So, yeah, you do have something to go after.
Well, thank you very much. That's it. Really appreciate it.
All righty. Thank you, Brent. And take us home, Anita.
Hey, young lady, you there?
Anita, unmute your phone.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Do you hear me now? Hello?
I'm John. Pleased to meet you. I'm John. Pleased to meet you, Anita.
Yeah.
By the way, thank you for all the fan mail. I've got those deeds. I've already started going through them.
Okay. So, yes, I have, I'm coming up with them regularly. So, I'm now wondering, so Jennifer and I are sort of on the same path because we have the same, we're under the same patent, but she's in a different section, of course, and she has different owners and different, so I'm just, this has been going on 2 years with off and on my own research for various reasons, and it's very difficult often to trace and find these things, but I would say Jennifer's ahead in the race, but I'm down to about, missing 50 years. So, and I'm still working on it. So my question is, should I have just started out and paid a title company? I mean, this was a lot of time, energy, and work. And if I were to pay one now, would they just fill in the blanks and correct anything that I have wrong? Is that what they might do?
Anita, what you can do is you can tell the title company, look, I'm a historian, and I have heard that there are some interesting facts surrounding my parcel, or this parcel, or that parcel, or her parcel, or the one underneath the Brooklyn Bridge in the middle of the, the East River. What happens is that you just tell them, look, I'm a historian. I would like to find everything I can about this. This is the information I already have. Could you finish a complete title search and fill in the blanks for me? And they'll do that. They'll stand on the shoulders of what you already have, okay? So that you don't have to pay them to redo it.
Correct. So they would verify plus fill in anything, and then
they'll verify a lot of what you've already done, and they'll add confirmation to that, and that's a very good thing for you to have done. Okay, so. To me, individuals that can afford, that have the resources, the nickels to go ahead and have a title company do what title companies do best, sick 'em doggy, you go, girl.
Well, I don't, but I may have to.
Well, I mean, that's when we start to squeeze out and figure out where the nickels do and don't come from. Isn't that right?
Right, but also I guess I would need to get from you who is in this area that would deal with New York or, you know.
We were talking a little treason and conspiracy about you a couple hours ago. We were about the deeds that you had already sent in and all the fan mail you'd already. We were talking about getting a conference call with you and Jennifer later on this week or the early part of this coming week.
Okay.
So if your ears were burning earlier, there's probably good reason. Michael and I were using your name in vain. Talking about you behind your back in front of your face, yeah.
I was practicing extreme patience to, and telling myself I would hear from you.
Well, there you go. Well,
okay.
Like they say in
all
Texas,
right.
Oil well.
Okay.
Thank you so very much, everyone. Ladies and gentlemen, we've had a wonderful call tonight. Share with your friends about these calls. Feel free to give them the phone number, the PIN number, the time, and the different topics on the different nights, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Saturday. Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Saturday are live calls. We don't do a call on Sunday night unless it's for something unusual that needs to be taken care of. Thursday's a recording, and Friday night we do scripture calls. So that's on a different pin, so you can't get it on this pin. And if you're interested in that, please just drop me a line, and I'll be glad to share that pin number with you for the call. So this is Wednesday now is tomorrow, and tomorrow will be Mr. Slevin. And Mr. Slevin will share with you how his uniquely crafted LLC is devoid of tax duties. Simple as that, by law. He's been doing it for nearly 20 years. And I like to add to that his formula, which is based on one person who comes in to get the LLC through them to actually initiate with two charitable religious trusts, each having 50% share in the LLC, and you being the trustee to each one of these trusts. This is a double web of protection, if you would, over and above what his history is. And then it perfectly segues into what Bernie offers at a later time when finances are more suited to do this, to get into what is referred to as the Golden Horseshoe. So it's a really important call to learn and understand about it, whether you are an entrepreneur or maybe just an employee. And when I say just an employee, I don't mean it in a derogatory sense. Been there, done that. I mean it in the sense that employees typically look in awe at the larger picture of the business owners and the people that make things happen in a large scale. And the truth of the matter is that this LLC is perfect for you to exchange places with your current employer. So if that sounds like a confusing statement, join us tomorrow night. Same phone number, same PIN, same time. Until then, good night, everyone, and be well.
The conference is now completed. Goodbye. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID, followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.